your dream, the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go, to right the unrightable wrong, to be better far than you are, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to be willing to give when there's no more to give, to be willing to die so that honor and justice may live. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest. And the world will be better for this. That one man, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us here, Red Ice TV. I'm Henrik. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. It's March 5th, 2026. Almost at 2025, actually. But holy smokes, spring just around the corner. And we got some good things to talk about today. Some positive things. A good redemption arc. Well, not a redemption arc. That's the wrong word. But an arc bending towards justice in this actual case, right? Because we're talking about Sam Melia's case over in the UK, having the state breathe down his neck and his wife's neck, his family's neck, for the last 5 years. A legal process. He was imprisoned. He basically put up some stickers back. I think it's back in 2019, if I have the timeline correct. We'll have Sam explain that to us. And now finally he's out. Able to talk to us, able to describe what happened, the whole process. It's crazy how many people we've kept an eye on and some that we've talked to, right? Like Sven Longshanks in the UK, the number of people that have been imprisoned. And actually quite a few things have gone down in that process as well during that time. But anyway, Sam Melia, welcome to Red Ice. Good to have you on the show. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing well. Yeah, it's spring is definitely springing. I think this is the first bit of sunshine we've had. Feels like forever. So being out with the kids in the garden, and they're loving it, and I'm loving it. So I'm glad to be here.
Nice. Welcome back, man. Good to see you.
Thank you.
We got some sunshine around here too. Ready for spring for sure. All right. So. Let's kind of take it from the top before we get into, you know, obviously what happens now and all that stuff, right? But for those who are not familiar with the case, did I get that right? 2019, is that when it was the 100 Handers Project? And I remember it at the time when that was going on. It was a great project. It was you and a few other lads, I believe, right? So kind of tell us that story preceding all the legal issues.
Well, originally it started back in 2015. I began publishing them. I think I opened up with the first maybe 30 or so stickers, but it all came from I'd had some dabbles in political activism and even joined a political party and ran for local office. And after the local office run, one of the anti-white NGOs that operate in the UK found my post on Facebook, and I'd been talking about Jewish supremacy and this kind of stuff. And the party I was running with was one of those kind of like Reform Now, but back in the day it was called For Britain, but it was a very kind of pro-Zionist, anti-immigration thing. So my anti-Semitic posts were enough for them to be like, you've got to go. So once I left that, and I'd been to a few demonstrations, and I wasn't too happy with where we were at in the UK. And I thought something else needs to be done. And at the time, there was a lot of bannings on social media, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and things like that as well. So I thought what needs to happen next is something that's going to be anonymous, something that doesn't rely on, you know, social media profiles in order to spread. And that's when I came up with this idea of the Hundred Handers. And the name lends itself from Greek mythology, which is the centimanes, which are these kind of many-headed, hundred-armed beasts that took down the Titans, I think it was, if memory serves. And I figured it's like, right, if I have central control over it, I'm the head, then it's like I can moderate the message to stay within UK speech laws, which are particularly stringent. So every sticker I produced was numbered. And with every release, you got all the stickers, and they were never, once they were published, they were never changed as well. So it's like if another sticker came out of the blue, it couldn't be attributed to the group and been, you know, if it'd been completely way past the what our speech laws would have got us in trouble for. And that served me well, because through the trial, they tried to introduce a number of stickers that just weren't attributed to the Hundred Handers at all, with very inflammatory messages. And I was able to say, what number was that? And it's, oh, it didn't have a number. Then it wasn't one of mine, you know, and we managed to get that evidence tossed. However, of course,
so that was an intentional strategy with the numbering of them like that?
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Same with the anonymity as well. Not like that was intentional, not to hide any illegal activity, but purely to avoid any ego attachment to it, no personality attachment to it. So you could say, well, yeah, just basically to make it so the stickers, all that mattered about them was the message. It didn't matter about who was putting them out or anything like that. And we continued, and we kind of grew steadily. And they started popping up in other countries, Australia, America, across Europe, and people offered to translate some of them to their native tongues. So it's like we ended up having a section of French stickers, German stickers, Dutch stickers. And eventually, I think it was late 2020, what is it, that same kind of anti-white NGO in the UK kind of exposed me. And it was because I think, what was it now? I think they got it from a voice. I think I'd appeared on some sort of stream, maybe with Laura as myself. And then I've got quite a distinctive stutter. And then I'd done some sort of stream as the Hundred Handers, and they put two and two together.
I thought you said they used like Palantir's latest AI technology to like backtrack to, you know. Well, I mean, they do shit like that. So I'm,
oh, yeah. Yeah, 100%. But I think this was just purely, it's like, oh, yeah, he's got a distinct accent and the stutter. And it's like, you know, and at that point as well, with the arrival of Patriotic Alternative here in the UK, I was winding down the Hundred Handers because I felt like we had a good vehicle moving forward. You know, like I attended that first conference and I was surrounded by these like attractive, well-spoken, smart people. And I was like, okay, this seems like something that's really going to go. So the Hundred Handers started to wind down at that point, really. And also after 5-6 years producing stickers every month, you kind of find yourself reinventing the wheel, where it's right. Like there's only so much that can be said. So,
yeah.
And then I'd kind of retired at late 2020. And then in April 2021, that's when the arrest came and I was picked up on my way to work. I'd just dropped off some parcels for Grandma Towers, which is Laura's business. And I turned around after grabbing a Red Bull from the fridge, and there was, I mean, he felt huge, but I'm sure he's probably about the same size as me, this copper, and he just immediately put a handcuff on me. And I was like, what's going on? And they led me outside and, you know, took everything out of my pockets. And they were like, it's like you're under arrest for, there were four charges initially. Two of them were quite severe. It was possession of terrorist material and something to do with like international funding for terrorism. And I was like, that's bizarre. And then the others were, you know, it was distribution of material meant to incite racial hatred, which is what the trial eventually went towards. And what they'd done is when they'd searched me, they'd taken my house keys. And while I was on my way to the police station, they had gone to my house and let themselves in. So the first thing Laura knew that they were there was the bedroom door opening and three ununiformed police officers walking in. And she thought she was about to get jumped by Antifa or something like that. There's no warning for this whatsoever. And they tore the house apart, searched everything. They took every digital device, not just phones and computers, but I think we had like a PlayStation 4 that went. Any USB drives that were lying about, SD cards. It's like just we had nothing. And I was questioned for, I think, about 4 hours total, gave no comment interviews throughout. But a lot of it was... It's just nonsense, really. It's like it didn't relate to the content of the stickers at that point. And those two serious charges were dropped as well, because I presume they'd searched the house, failed to find any terrorist material or stacks of Russian money or whatever they were looking for. And
they can just make up charges then.
Yeah.
Like if there's no reasonable, like a plausible indication that this might be a crime, hence we need to investigate. That just doesn't make sense at all.
It's not like the project required huge amounts of funding. Like I designed it to be as cheap as possible, so like the stickers were available from Amazon for pence, and then the printer itself is like a £30 label printer.
Yeah.
So it's not like this had to be funded by an enemy state or anything like that.
Come on. Iran money was just flowing right in, you know.
yeah. But in order to find me, it had taken a 2-year counterterror investigation. So you do wonder if after 2 years, do they have to justify the cost? You know,
Good
and then
point.
When they go to a what do they call them here? Not barrister, but when they go to the courts here to request a search warrant, would they get it based on he's put out some stickers?
Exactly. You know what I mean? So they had to set a higher bar than they knew that actually could go for. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was told by my solicitor as well. He said it's like when counterterror approach the courts, they ask, they say, you know, we need you to jump. They go, how high? You know, there's no questioning. Right. Going like, what's the intelligence backing up here?
Yeah, what's your proof? Yep.
Yeah. So I ended up being released on bail. And I think for about 2 years, we were just kind of had it looming over us. And then we started chasing them and being like, can we either charge us or just drop this? Because nothing seems to be coming.
Were you, and obviously, during that period, you were handcuffed, so to speak, in your ability to speak or to act or do anything. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, the bail restrictions weren't too bad in terms of my political activity. It ramped up after the arrest. I think it wasn't long after that we did our first kind of like megaphone demo in the street and everything. The restrictions were weird things like you can't stay away from home overnight. So, I mean, obviously that put pay to any sort of holidays or anything. But the only time I really tried was there was a PA conference and they'd been pursuing me because there was an encrypted USB stick and it contained the membership data for my local region in Patriotic Alternative, which I led, and they couldn't get into it. And when I asked to stay away for the conference, the officer was saying, when is this going to end? And he goes like, listen, it ends when you want it to end, obviously, being like, you know, just give us the details and let you run free. And they were just like, this guy. But when he eventually came to bring the charges, he didn't seem happy about it. I think if he's running around in like the counterterrorism offices, I imagine him being there. You ever see that film, The Other Guys, with Mark Wahlberg? And like the
rings
rest of
a bell,
the
but it was, yeah.
Are, like doing really cool things and everything. Right. He's there doing parking tickets. And it's like the rest of the counterterrorist offices, they're doing like Mission Impossible missions, stopping people from laying pipe bombs and everything. Then he's there going like,
they're saving the nation.
I've got some stickers, guys. And they're like, oh my God, this guy, you know? And they finally brought the charges and attached to the distribution to, of material meant to incite racial hatred was this criminal damage card, encouraging racially aggravated criminal damage. were like, criminal damage. And it was for the stickers on street furniture, lampposts and stuff like that. And the way I designed the stickers, it's just paper stickers. They're biodegradable. They fade away after a few weeks. It's like they're not there to permanently scar the landscape or anything. And it's like, I mean, stickers are everywhere, you know? It's like bands put them up, political groups, religions, and it's like no one's chasing them for criminal damage. So surely this won't stand. And that's what my barrister said as well before the trial. He was like, there's no way. Because first you'd have to prove that it's criminal damage, which would then mean all stickers are criminal damage. And then you'd have to prove it's racially aggravated, you know? And then we had the trial a year after that. That was pretty intense. But again, yeah. the counterterrorism sergeant, when he arrived at the court, I really wanted to kind of get a feel for him, to see if he was coming in, you know, very confident. And he wasn't. I mean, he looked ill. And when he was up in the stand being questioned by the prosecution, who's on his side, he didn't have anything. He wasn't there full of fire and brimstone or anything. A lot of the stickers had QR codes to links, and the prosecution would tee him up and be like, oh, where did this lead? You know, expecting something really bad. I think there was a link to Red Ice on one of them. But every time the prosecution would say, where did this go? And he'd just be like, I don't know. And it's like, come on, man. But we eventually, because the prosecution's kind of kill shot was like, oh, how many crimes have resulted from these stickers? And the officer was like, oh, there's been like 34 or something like that. And I was like, I don't think so. So I put my hand up, because you're in a fishbowl right at the back of the court. You're just watching all this play out in front of you. And I put my hand up, and the judge seemed quite amused by this. So he let my barrister come back. And I said to my barrister through the glass, I was like, ask him how many have actually been incited by these. Because I think the crimes he's talking about are just the criminal damage of stickers on lampposts. But how many... He's saying all these crimes have been incited. How many have actually happened? And my barrister went back up and asked him, it's like, has there been actual incitement of racial hatred from any of these stickers? And the counterterrorism work were forced to say, no, there hasn't been. You know, over at this point, it would have been 6 years of these stickers being out there in the world. There was no actual citation of any sort of racial hatred. And to say that apparently that's what I meant to do, kind of begs the question. It's like, well, was he just entirely inept at stirring up racial hatred? Like, it doesn't feel like it'd be that hard to do. You know. Here we were, no crime committed, we were in court and basically having to defend myself from the state, who was alleging that it's like, when you wrote these stickers secretly in your mind, you were being racist and you wanted to incite racial hatred. And so much of our defense was basically, I mean, this was evidence that the prosecution entered. It was private messages going back 5 years. And I'm talking to people who are friends. I've got no reason to lie to them. You know, I think I'm talking in private. And I'm saying these stickers are here to start a conversation, to let white people know that there's other white people who think like them in their local vicinity. And they couldn't find any like private messages of me saying, like, it's like, I'm doing this, but on the sly, I've got nefarious intent.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and it included to the point where, like, I literally had rules that went out with every pack of stickers, and it said, don't place these anywhere where it could be considered inflammatory or intimidatory. You know, so it's like all the evidence seems to present someone who's trying to stay within in the law. Even to the point where I think a few years back, there'd been one sticker I'd removed from the archive. And with every new release, there was a change log, which had the date of release and then also what's changed in this archive. And there was one release where it says, oh, I've removed sticker 169 because I feel it borders on incitement and we don't condone the use of this sticker going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the entire project was to incite, why would I be deleting stickers that I feel pushed too far? You know, it was madness. And it felt like I was going crazy in the back of that courtroom.
How long was, like, it going on for? How long was the...
It was a week and a half, including, oh my gosh, I think it was about a a day and a half maybe of jury deliberation.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, but so much of it as well is just the prosecution. Like you spend maybe 3-4 days just trawling through the evidence before you even get a say. And that's just the way British courts work. I had an American lawyer friend who was sitting in, and he was losing his mind because obviously, you know, if something comes up that's false, you can go objection,
right,
and it can be struck,
yeah,
you know, like there and then. Whereas here in the British courts, I think the prosecution entered this evidence of a newspaper article about razor blades behind stickers. And,
oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's like a left-wing meme that yeah, like, right-wing stickers have razor blades beneath them. How that would work, I don't know. I mean, you see a sticker, I think you'd notice if there was a bloody razor blade hiding behind it. But, I stuck my hand up and I called the barrister over and I was like, what are you doing? It's like, that's not ever happened. It's like, and definitely not with my stickers. And he was like, oh, yeah, I've made a note of it, and we'll go over it when you're in deposition.
In
like,
4 days from now, we'll be able to talk about it.
I was like, right, so we're just going to allow that to embed with the jury, you know, take root, maybe have a weekend before I get in
right,
the box. And it's like, and yeah, then at the end of it, you've just got to try and work backwards and work against the mountain of evidence that they've put against you and try and deal with all the kind of spurious allegations. So, but yeah, the American was just like, I think he stormed in with my barrister once and he was like, this court system is like, there's a reason we left. Like, well, all right, dude. Yeah.
Yikes. All right. So that whole process, you're going through all that.
Mm.
What did it boil down to? Because let's talk about the stickers specifically then and remind people, obviously, some of the messages and slogans and you know, memes, whatever that you had on there. But was it boiled down to like, these are the 10 kind of that's like of interest to the court, or like, how did that work? Did they hone in on a few things, or did they take everything into account?
Well, of the, I think there was total about 300 in the archive by the time it finished. But the counterterrorism police presented 14 that 14, were kind okay, of mm-hmm, that they felt constituted an offence, you know, taken altogether. Again, I mean, the idea wasn't ever to put up all 300 stickers in one place, so you shouldn't receive all the messages at once. It's kind of like picking random words from different pages of a book and being like, well, put them together, you know. But these 14 stickers, most of them were relating to the rape gangs here in the UK. And, I mean, 2 years ago feels like a different age.
Yeah,
since
true,
then. I came out of prison to find, you know, I was in court defending whether they even existed. And then I came out of prison to find out that the government's kind of like, yes, they did exist. Yes, we knew all along.
Yeah.
Oh, we also know there is a demographic of Pakistani men who are predominantly involved in it. And it's like, I had to argue that they even like our defense evidence
pack
was basically, it's like, look, here's media, here's politicians talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, to address it is not in and of itself racist. And so that was kind of wild coming out to that. But those are the 14 that the prosecution thought,
yeah,
you know, these are the worst. But then they had an expert witness. And this guy is Professor, I think, Paul Jackson. He's of a university in the UK. But he's basically an Antifa professor. He maintains the Searchlight archive. Searchlight's like a far left communist Antifa publication that's been going for decades, you know, back when the BNP, the NF and everything were about. And he maintains that archive. And then you look at the courses that he teaches and it's like, you know, 100 years of far right rhetoric and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, this guy. And somehow he's not considered biased by the courts, but he came in and he highlighted a bunch of different stickers. And the judge was like, hang on, I thought we were talking about these 14 and you're talking about these ones. And then the judge just asked the prosecution, it was like, well, do you want to include these ones as well? And if we're going to include them, we'll include all of them. And I thought this would be good because once you include all of them, you realize that the project wasn't primarily about race or immigration. It covered everything. You had things, you had stickers just saying like, lift weights, stop watching porn.
Right.
You know, it's like just after 6 years, you'd covered almost every imaginable topic. So I thought, this is good. And when we went home that night, me and Laura went through the 300 stickers, and we actually totaled up how many make reference to race, you know, even as loosely as like calling it, you know, diversity, multiculturalism, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be 13%. And I thought, it's like, well, this has got to be a kill shot, surely, for my defense, to be kind of like literally 1 in 10 mentioned race. So how can this whole project? But, you know, the jury didn't feel that way. It was kind of wild. And by the time we'd reached the end of the trial, I think I did well in the box. The people, you know, friends and family observing said that I did well. And my barrister's closing statement as well was really good, really leaning on the kind of free speech angle, because from the beginning, the prosecution had admitted that the stickers were all, they may be extreme, but they are lawful. And then he also admitted that they were true, but the jury was to disregard whether they were true or not, because apparently the truth is no defense in court.
That's correct.
And you're just like, yeah. Right, okay, so we've got lawful stickers, true stickers. However, what really matters is the secret goings on inside this big head of mine. It's like
so it is ultimately a thought crime, then, you could literally say.
Oh, yeah. 100%, yeah. Because that's all the evidence that they brought up for, like, here's why these true legal stickers are an offence, was kind of like, here's some jokes he made 3 years ago and everything. And it's just like, okay, so now I'm having to explain jokes to a jury. And it's like, you know, there's nothing worse than that, having to explain why you laughed about something. It's like, oh my God, it's like, it just feels really cringe. And it's like, if you don't find it funny, then I guess
2 years later was a meme that now you've kind of like, you've left that. expendable. What do you call it? Like, yeah, it's some in the moment, right? Usually those types of things. Anyway.
Yeah. And it's like the idea that something like that, eventually you're going to get pulled up on that. There's going to be a screenshot of it in court. And you'll be asked to explain the full context behind it. And you're like,
oh my gosh.
Oh my God. It's like, it immediately puts you on a defensive posture, which looks bad, you know.
Right.
But like I say, the barrister's closing statement really leaning on that free speech angle. And it's like, even if you don't agree, we understand that these are legal. He was fantastic. But yeah, that jury, just, I really couldn't believe it. But that's juries now in this modern multicultural age. It's, you know, supposed to be a jury of your peers. I mean, three of them weren't even my countrymen.
Right.
There was one black guy who seemed to be fresh off the boat, like his accent was still heavily Africanized. And it's like, right, well, I mean, that's three people who immediately are probably going to bury me.
Yeah.
You know. So it's, and then it's like asking white people to defend another white man's free speech to non-whites. There's not many who are willing to do it.
Yeah, because they deliberate among themselves, right?
Yeah, so yeah, they, yeah, for a day and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that, again, I had my hopes raised, because at one point we were called back in after maybe 2 hours, and the jury asked the judge, it's like, are we supposed to take just the 14 or the whole archive? And he said, well, you take the whole archive. And there was one guy, kind of really real shit lib kind of phenotype, but he hated me from the moment he saw me. But he like visibly sank in his chair when they're informed to take the whole archive in. And I thought, cool, that's because when you look at all the archive, you can't say this was clearly the sole focus of it was to incite racial hatred. But then, yeah, a day later, they came out, and I think we got called back to court from the canteen, and we had our child with us, and Laura stayed back in the canteen with her, and I think we went up there, got the verdict, and of course the jury was dismissed, and they exited via the canteen, and Laura saw them coming out, and you know, they're all laughing and joking together and everything, and I just think it's like, you've no idea what you just did to me. You know, at this point, the charges, you know, we're talking 3 to 7 years potentially. And it's just like, you know, Laura's pregnant at the time, you know, and it's like, I think she was 6-7 months along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just like, I'm if this is custodial, I'm going to jail. I'm going to miss the birth of my second daughter. I just can't believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which you did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was calling Laura about every hour while I was inside when she was going into labor. And then I think I gave up at like 10 o'clock. I said, I'll let you get some sleep. And Violet arrived in the early hours of the morning. And when I called her at 7 a.m., there was a little gurgling voice on the other end of the line. I think we had a visit scheduled 3 days after that. So I got to hold her when she was very young, but just missed that. I mean, you've got kids, that moment when they're just
that's
fresh.
That's a crime. That's a crime in and of itself. You know what I mean? Holy smokes. So, okay, so I do want to kind of talk more about that too, obviously, afterwards and all that and the prison time. But so based on the jury's conclusion in the case or whatever, the judge, because I thought it was this line too, right? I mean, that's kind of the takeaway here is really what is the title of your book, obviously, that you've written about this, which is Legal, Truthful, Guilty, right? But this idea, it doesn't matter, excuse me, it doesn't matter that the stickers are legal, doesn't matter that it's the truth. We know what's in your head, basically, right? You bad, right? You're a bad person. Yeah. So we got to make an example out of you, essentially, right? Does that in some way kind of come out of the judge's mouth at some point?
No, I mean, the judge during the trial seemed not favorable to me, but fair at the very least. And there was a month between the verdict and the sentence. So we were allowed to go home for a month and then we came back. And then when we re-entered that courtroom, I was optimistic about my chances of it being a suspended sentence, which could have been basically, sent home on bail and probation. But as soon as he came out, I was like, this is a different guy. And the way he was talking was very, very solemn, like, oh, this is a serious crime. And he was very dramatic about it as well. He came out and he's like, oh, still got a lot to think about with this, so we'll reconvene in 20 minutes. And we left, and my solicitor was like, you're probably done. He's been overly dramatic to kind of, basically, he's going to bury you, and he needs to make it seem like he's given it a lot of thought, but he'll have pre-written a whole speech in it and everything. And we went back in, and this, because when he was advising the jury on how to give a verdict, he quoted that, I think it's misquoted as Voltaire, you may disagree, but I'll defend your right to the death to say it, or something like that. But he quoted that to the jury, which implied to me that it's like, you're basically giving the jury a get out to be like, not guilty, I would have thought. But yeah, when he came back out for sentencing, all of a sudden it was like, you are a filthy anti-Semite and you're threatening the fabric of society and everything. And he quoted, actually, because there was pro-Palestine protests in the UK at the time, and I think some of them had made death threats to MPs, and he said, like, we need to make a example of anti-Semites like yourself. And people found his Twitter afterwards, and it turns out he's very Zionist. And I don't think the stickers we'd addressed in the courtroom, like I say, they were primarily about the rape gangs. There was some anti-Zionist stuff in there talking about Jewish occupied government and things like that, but none of those really came up. So maybe he just wasn't aware of those. You know, I hadn't touched the particular nerve that he had. Following that, as soon as he started talking, I was like, he's going to get me. I just dead-eyed him. I didn't want him to know that it had any reaction to me as well. And, 2 years custodial, and I was just like, this guy, this guy, and stood up, said I love you to Laura, and then they took me into the back room, and that's where the kind of jail journey began.
So 2 years. So that was what. So when was the sentencing? What year was that again? Remind
that
me.
That was March 1st,
2024. Okay, that's right. Okay, yeah. So that's still. See how long that process did, because in this case, obviously you got jail time, you were in prison. That's obviously the punishment. But I'm saying the process is also the punishment. You know what I mean? Like the stress of that, the whole thing, right? And that it's prolonged and dragged out that way. And as you said, then what's interesting, then you're in there for to about 2 years, right? And then, and the even in those 2 years, even proceeding from the time like the initial charges were had to when you were in prison, that then the temperament, the attitudes, the discussions in the media of these types of topics have already begun to change, and then it's almost like racer pace those other 2 years. And what you, I'm not sure how much you are able, are you able to keep up with these things when you're in the prison? What was that like?
I mean, in the prison, you've got access to TV, but there's only 20 channels, so you can catch up on like BBC News and everything, but you can read into headlines and understand stories a bit more when you're aware as we are. And then once I was out, cause we have a thing in the UK where you, you basically do either half or three quarters of your term, depending on how long you've got away. So I would have been out of prison on February 28th. And then the remaining year I would have spent on license, which is basically you have a number of restrictions on you, but you are relatively free. You know, you've got an ankle monitor and everything. But because of the prisons are so overcrowded in the UK, Keir Starmer introduced something called SDS 40, which meant that everyone served 40%. Which for me was really fortunate because it meant I got out on December 17th. So I was out in time for Christmas with the kids, good. Which was amazing.
Yeah, good.
I really wasn't looking forward to missing that while I was away. And but then the restrictions that they had me on. But yeah, in terms of the acceleration, like I say, during the trial, just having to argue that rape gangs exist, I came out and I'm watching Newsnight on the BBC and they've got four or five of the survivors of these gangs, and the Newsnight presenter is being like, yeah, it's predominantly Pakistani Muslims and everything. And then I think there was some police commissioner or something who went like, oh, you know, we shouldn't forget that primarily white people engage in these crimes, and these survivors going, no, we're talking about something very different from like your uncle molesting you. We're talking, yeah, you know, just potentially hundreds of men having predated upon these girls.
Gosh.
And then the conversation since then, it's like, you know, we've had Restore Britain just pop up and all of a sudden we've got a sitting MP saying millions must go, whereas I feel like all it took was a month ago. It was still kind of like deporting people was just completely taboo.
Yeah.
Now it seems like an arms race between Labour, Conservatives, Reform and Restore to be. It's like right, who's deporting the most?
You know, at least in rhetoric. Yeah. But yes, I get your point. You know,
yes,
at least
yeah, in rhetoric. Yeah. Until I see tires leaving the tarmac, I am skeptical.
Yes, yeah. Agree. So the environment's changed tremendously, and even in this time there was, I mean, I think maybe they started then. It's a little bit hard to piece together the timeline and remember every event exactly when they happened, but. Regardless, I swear, the last 2 years alone, massive amounts of protest outside of these migrant hotels, that whole debate, mm-hmm. it popped off and exploded, essentially. What I'm saying is, like, you see the whole country, you know, rising up where migration, demographics, these become the biggest topics in the country, you know mm-hmm. what I mean?
The Southport attacks, I think they were, was it late July or earlier August?
Something like that, yeah.
But that was, Rudy Cabana or
yep,
something?
Correct.
But when he stabbed all those girls, three died. And I think that was something that really touched people. And it was also very, you know, the rape gangs, it's always historical. You know, the men who are in court for it now did it 10, 15 years ago, which allows a sort of kind of mental disconnect for most people. You know, it's something that did happen, but it's not happening now, you know. I can guarantee you in 15 years' time, there's going to be someone in court for doing it today.
Right, know? Yeah, yeah.
But the Southport attacks, I think, really fired people up, and it's not something – we haven't really seen that over here. You know, even the Manchester Arena bombing, it's – we saw the aftermath, whereas here there was video of, you know, kids – bleeding out on the street and the person who done it as well looks psychotic, where you're just like, how, why was he even here? You know, this person just looks so alien to Britain. And a number of the men who were arrested during the unrest following it came through the prison that I was in.
Really?
And they were just getting hammered, and they'd been promised, go guilty, we'll get you through the trial quick and we'll give you a soft sentence. And instead, because of the media scrutiny, judges were absolutely hammering these guys. So it's, you had people who, it's like, you know, family men, this is the first time that they've been out on any sort of political action. And they're like, oh, I threw a traffic cone and I'm doing two years and 6 months, you know? And I think there was one guy where the judge literally said, like, I wouldn't normally give you a custodial sentence. However, the media scrutiny means that I am required to. And it's like, jeez. So actually, I think if the guys have gone admitted not that guilty,
the media scrutiny, really?
The judge, yeah. Really? I've got it quoted in my book.
I mean, that's, we kind of allude to it, obviously, and we're aware of it, you know, but you in terms of like how much power the media has in some cases, certainly they're lapdogs and they walk around and they just they become disseminators of press releases from the government or something like that. But in other cases, it seems that they're also driving the kind of the cultural narrative in a way that, you know, you kind 100%. Of you lose it feels like they've lost a lot of credibility. I guess that's my point, which they have, but that doesn't mean they've lost the power, if that makes sense.
Oh, no. I think the power is still very much there. But yeah, the credibility is just completely tanked. I mean, especially, you know, with Gaza, this new war in Iran, it's like that credibility just, it seems to be going further and further down, and people are looking at elsewhere to Telegram, you know, OSINT channels and everything to get exactly what's happening on the ground, rather than the sanitized version that, because again, that played into why I had to be shut down, you know, whereas the media did report on the rape gangs and everything like that. Mm-hmm. However, it was muted. And then the context was always isolation, where it's like, this has happened, but there's no relation to any group. And it's just an individual did this to another individual, and that's all. And I think part of what makes them fear us is because it's like, we're willing to say, it's like, no, that group attacked our group, and we can tot up the number of attacks from that group to our group, and then come to a satisfying conclusion from that, where we go, they just need to be gone. Whereas, yeah, it's the media can report on any number of these things, and it's always, don't do anything next. Don't get active. Don't join a political party that's promising to get rid of them or anything like that. Whereas, you know, that's the opposite to what we say, where it's kind of like, it's like, no, if you're angry about this, get involved, do something.
Right. Yeah. You know? No, exactly. So how was the time in the prison? Take us through that a little bit. And what your experience, where you moved around? We talked with Sven Longshanks here, there's a couple of months ago as well, another political prisoner in the UK. But he, you know, he talked how many times he was moved and is the ordeal of everything. Like, how was it like for you? Tell us, give us an insight into it a little bit.
I mean, it's scary going in. I think for every man, it's kind of probably one of the scariest kind of places where, you know, you're going to be tested. And especially because so much of our media comes from America. You think prison is just like nothing but shivving and raping. And, thankfully British prisons are not quite like that. So, not much raping. But yeah, when I was going in, I was kind of like, oh my God, it's like, I'm going to be amongst these people. It's like, you know, the kind of criminal class or whatever. It's like, how will I fare with them? And turns out pretty well. Like I made a lot of friends of people in there. I never faced any sort of danger or anything like that. It's for a lot of them in there, it is kind of like an adult daycare, because it's just a kind of temporary holiday away from their regular criminal lives. And when they get out, they'll go straight back to it. But I did well. And then you're talking to other prisoners, and obviously it depends what you're in for. If you're in for sexual offences, rape, or a pedophile or anything like that, you're in a lot of danger. Like if you're even seen on like the other side of a fence from regular prisoners, they're telling you exactly what they're going to do to you as soon as they get their hands on you. And they have their own wing where they're kept entirely separate. But for me, every prisoner I spoke to was supportive. If I had to speak to, or if there was a, you know, some Asian fella talking to me, then I'll start criticizing Israel, and they'd be like, yeah. You know? So it's like, you know, we ran the gamut. But then the officers as well, they, I mean, for one, they appreciated that I wasn't either on drugs or mental. because a lot of people in there are both. But then, you know, you'd have a quiet word with some officers and they'd know what you're in for. They'd seen the kind of stuff that you'd been putting out there while you're outside. And they'd be like, oh, yeah, I can't stand them as well, mate. You know, got an entire bloody wing of them here. And it's like, I just need to ship them off, you know. And it's like, all right, cool. And they'd look out for you as well. So I did pretty well. And by the end of it, the wing I was on, the kind of group of friends that we were in, essentially kind of like informally running the wing. I mean, don't get me wrong, I was kind of riding their coattails because they were all kind of gypsy traveler types. So they all, you know, they had cousins and everything like that, and they were willing to, you know, put the stick about if need be, but they were great with me. And yeah, it's I never faced any trouble, you know.
Okay, well, that's
but yeah, I did get shuffled about a few times. I think I did get moved from Leeds to Hull. Leeds was a lot more diverse than Hull. Hull was pretty much a homogenous white prison.
It's really?
In East Yorkshire, which is a very white area of okay. Yorkshire. And Leeds was getting steadily more diverse as I was there over the two months that I was there. Especially the Muslim contingent was rising. And I think the amount of mail that I was receiving made the prison very aware that it's like, if something bad happens to this guy, it's gonna make news.
Yeah.
You know, so I think they wanted to move me to a comparatively safe prison.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Yeah, because we've heard about all the issues with Prislam, they call it, right? All the Muslims in there. What a big issue that is. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And beyond that, anything that like stood out or memorable to you specifically, you know, from the whole period? And
yeah, there was a guy who Joker smiled himself on the wing at one point. And he was a pretty intimidating character. But I ended up having to clean his cell after he'd sliced himself up, blood all up the walls and everything like that. But they moved him out.
White guy?
But the guy who had cut himself and basically not allowed it to heal. So he just had this huge smile.
Yeah. Was he a white guy? Okay.
White guy? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the amount of mental illness is pretty wild in there.
Yeah.
Seems to be like almost half the population is a bit loopy. So dealing with that.
It's interesting. All the Western countries well, did like, away like, with the mental asylums and institutions. And
they
now
did.
It's just,
yeah.
It's meds or prison. That there. Seems to be what they're opting for to deal with it.
Yeah.
Or both, I guess. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So what do you... What's your takeaway here? Like, what do you feel? I mean, because it's so this is so unnecessary, right? I mean, on every level, and I don't just mean obviously you feel that on a personal level, but I'm saying even on a society, like the cost of these things, the you taking up the space even in the prison if it's overcrowded, like all those things, right? There's so many aspects here to this of how ludicrous this is, but how they have to continue to, as the judge in that case said, right? Make an example essentially out of you. See, I don't think that works. I think it's the opposite effect. I mean, your case got out there quite a bit. I think even in your post you had about, you know, I'm finally out, basically, I'm back, that your post, I'm back. Mm. You mentioned that, of course, you know, even Elon boosted, you know, your name out there, your post, your story, some of the memes that were going around essentially of like all these rapists and... people that had done all kinds of things, right? That had lesser sentence than you did, for example, right? So it really got out there. So obviously, net result in terms of what the state wanted to do here, total opposite effect, if you ask me. What's your sense of it?
Oh, yeah. Like they completely embarrassed themselves with this. I think they'd hoped that it would have a chilling effect. And I think the inverse has happened where, I mean, clearly, you know, in those last two years since I've gone, it's not like anyone's been kind of like, it's like, oh, have you heard about the case of Samuel Mila? I won't speak out. It's like, no, more people are speaking out than ever before. And I think this always happens when a state has to wield such obvious power unjustly. It just messes with their their like not eligibility, legitimacy. That's the word I'm looking for. But it's like no one saw my case and went like, yeah, that's well deserved. It's like people are like, really, stickers? And even the probation officer who I spoke to prior to sentencing, she compiles a pre-sentence report and that's then given to the judge. And even she was like, prison isn't going to change this guy. It's not going to do him any good. He's not going to rehabilitate via prison. So we recommend suspending the sentence so that he can be home with his family, which would probably be the healthiest thing for him. And that was just ignored. And then while I was in prison, I was designated a terrorism offender, despite it only being a public order offence, which meant that I had to be in a solo cell by myself because, you know, if I was in with someone else, the risk of radicalization would be too high. And then upon release, I was being handled by the National Security Division for stickers. And my charges were described as, or my crime was described as terrorism adjacent. And it's just like, what is going on? It's like, but this is what multiculturalism requires. It's just such a heavy hand of a police state because it is just paper thin. You know, all these lies that are needed to keep it going day by day can be poked through so easily that all it takes is, you know, one sticker saying it's okay to be white or something like that. And it's like they just lose their minds because it just puts paid to the lies that have been put out there. You know, I mean, the restrictions that I was on under the National Security Division, I think there was 30 of them in total, but it was like, obviously can't speak to anyone in Patriotic Alternative. Thankfully, they made an exception for my wife, who's the deputy leader, which obviously made the restriction a bit null and void.
Right, yeah.
But then it's like, if I make any new connection, I have to provide counter-terrorism with details to facilitate a background check. So it's like if I was at the playground with the kids and I made friends with another father there, it's like I was expected to provide his name and date of birth to counterterrorism, you know, to prevent my network growing, you know. It's kind of like, what are we doing? And every week was like an hour or 2 hours with my probation officer just drilling me on my politics. And it's like he was just the archetypal kind of like shit lib boomer, just being like, it's like, what do you mean black people can't be English? And it's like, I'll explain this to you for the 10th time, but genetics are a thing. Okay. And it's like, there's people who are indigenous to a land, and it's like the African who landed here 10 years ago, even, it's like, he's not indigenous yet. You know, it's like, oh my God. But I mean, I think they were, by the time I was released halfway through my sentence, I think then they realized that my profile had grown massively. Like, this had completely backfired for them. It was a real black eye for them. And I think that is partly due to everyone who shared it about. I think if I'd just gone away and no one had heard from me, or no one had made a stink about it, it wouldn't have been too bad for them. But everyone capitalized on it, and more people saw it. So I think that was a fantastic thing to do. And, you know, and then we've come out and it's a whole new world.
It is, isn't it? It's fascinating how fast, but it's because those sentiments have been growing and percolating under the surface for such a long time. And that's why, I'll say this, that's why I think the state is correct. Because it's not about the stickers. It was never about the stickers, right? As we know, because they know that there is a rising tide and a pressure both against them and their legitimacy, but also the line that they're trying to drive with in terms of immigration, in terms of demographics, in terms of the fact that white British people can't assert themselves, they can't have any interest, they can't stand up for themselves. It's only so long you can keep the lid on that. And this is really kind of a, how do I put it? The pressure cooker hasn't exploded fully entirely in terms of what it can, the damage that can happen from that. But it's begun to happen, if that makes sense. That process has... It's too late. They're not going to put this back in the bag, so to speak. I mean, look at even with like Rupert Lowe and the narrative that he's driving and this kind of reform, restore, you know, Tiffy, and although, of course, it's a long way from social media posts or even arguments, be they IRL or online, to actual political action. But the point is, at least those discussions are happening now. At least it's out there. It's widely known. Everyone's talking about migration in the UK. Everyone's talking about demographics. Massive amounts of people in the UK want mass deportations, for example. Like, this isn't going away. So I think this, your case in this, to put it in context to that, in the time, it was one of these last dang efforts to like, let's impressive. Let's just find someone and just, you know, put them in jail. And maybe that will kind of simmer things down a little bit. And of course, and as they do that, it just gets worse for them, right? And it just gets worse. And the more they do that, even the debacle, as you said, after Southport, and then it was Epping, I think, the other hotel protest, and there was more people arrested there. I have lost track of them, in fact, of how many there have been. But the point is, that's not going away, Sam. None of these people are backing up. People don't care anymore. They're losing their nation. They're losing their people. That's it. This is an existential battle, and I don't think they understand that on some degree here. Do they?
No, they don't understand it at all. I mean, dealing with these agents of the state who were sent to, and I'm quoting here, realign Mr. Melia's views, you realize that multiculturalism just is for them. There's no questioning it or you know, what's brought it about or anything. It just is, and it's always been here, and there's nothing we can do to change it. So the problem is with the people who are resisting, and it's like, no, this really is relatively recent. Like within one generation, basically, the kind of mass migration to the UK really accelerated in the late 90s. So it's like we haven't been here for long, and it's very reversible. You know, it's far from set in stone at this point. So it's like, they have to shut everything down. And the pressure cooker analogy is fantastic because their only reaction to it is to kind of cram it all back in there and then shove the lid back on and keep the heat on. And it's like, well, that's, as far as pressure cookers go, the next time it blows is going to be a lot worse. So it's like, yeah, you have something like the Southport unrest and you get a bunch of people nicked and then crush it back down. And Keir Starmer made it very clear that it's like, we're not having this. You know, it's like, this has got to be cut short. And it's like, well, nothing's changed that means that situation isn't going to happen again, that some attacker doesn't target a Taylor Swift dance class or some other, you know, basically the whitest thing that he could possibly attack at the time. So the next time it happens, you can expect similar, if not worse, unrest. And it's like, and it's just going to keep building up like that. And we've been begging them for an outlet for, you know, decades now, National Front, BNP. And every time they've basically robbed it of a platform and then crushed it. And where did you think the British people were going to go? And it's like they're getting backed more and more into a corner. The diversity is coming for everyone. More and more people see it. It's on their streets, in the schools, it's on TV. It's so unavoidable now. There's no way to stick your head in the sand and pretend, you know, it's the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and they're all fantastic. It's like, no, it's like you're dealing with them every day. And it's negatively impacting your life every day.
Yeah.
So more and more people show up to this thing. And like the Epping Hotel protests, which were fantastic in that they were large and they kept going and they kept growing. And eventually the council had to relent. And it's like, okay, so it can be pushed back on. It can work. We just need enough people. And now, like I say, with Restore, you know, breaking 100,000 members within like 2 weeks, it's like, well, this hasn't happened before. There's an energy there that just wasn't there for Reform, because I think it's just a different. I mean, everyone kind of knew about Farage, didn't they?
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of he'd make the noises, but Farage is Farage. He'll disappear at the crucial moment, and obviously, we've got quotes from him from years ago where he's celebrating the demise of the BNP and everything. It's like,
yeah, I mean, he in a roundabout way even said it just about a week ago, I think, or something like that. Like, none have done more than me to destroy, you know, ruin the far right or something. You know, he's done this, you know, every so often over the last couple of decades, essentially.
He admits that he's clearly
a steam valve, right? In a way, just a temporary outlet for frustration. More yap and nothing happens, and then, you know, back to sleep we go. Yeah. Supposedly,
he's like appealing to Zog and being like, "I'm your guy." You know, if you need someone to control the working class white or whatever, it's I'm the best guy for doing it. You know, and between him and Tommy Robinson, essentially they've got it stitched up. But as we see now, the conversation happening around what is a Briton, you know, an ethnic Briton, that conversation has to be had before we can then move into political action on the back of that, because either, well, that conversation is always going to have to come about, and it's better that it's happening now than later on down the line. But that, again, it can't be put away now. You know, we can't have politicians kind of doing a mealy mouth kind of like the values Britain, where it's kind of like, well, as long as you subscribe to the five values that could also be applied to literally any other country, as long as you ascribe to them, you're British. And it's like, that's not enough anymore. And no. And it never will be again.
Correct. And I think for the most part, the British, the actual British people have had enough of that, and they don't buy it anymore. I think it's a very, it's a very interesting time ahead for so many European countries, any Western country, essentially, because we're more or less largely dealing with the same type of situation, different configurations, different, you know, potential of how it might play out, but the overall themes are certainly the same, right? So I'm very interested, and on one end excited, but then I also know it, as we always know, it's always going to get worse before it does get better. And I don't think we've hit rock bottom yet, unfortunately. I think they're going to try to do a last push, you know what I mean? They were talking right now, even with the Iran conflict, like, oh, we might get another few million, migrants piggybacking off of the heightened conflict because it's spreading all over the Middle East. It's not just between like Iran and Israel or something that these rockets are flying. It's in all kinds of Middle Eastern countries now. So they're like saying, oh, prepare for another refugee wave. It's like, oh boy, you know, here we go again, right?
Yeah, and you're getting all the people who fell for the kind of like, we fight them over there so that they won't come here.
Yeah,
it's like,
right.
With egg on their face again.
Yep.
You know, it's like, I don't know how many times this has to happen before we realize, like, literally, it's like any geopolitical situation will result in more migrants for us. It's like, that's the guarantee.
Yeah, and even if it's, but if it's peaceful, then it's also reasons to come, obviously.
Right? Yeah,
because then it doesn't matter.
Pilot moments want to leave. It's like, oh, great, thanks. and you can have the Afghan thing where it's like, you know, they take over their country again from the invading force, and you think, all right, cool, you know, the Afghans are back in charge of Afghanistan, and then you find out there's British politicians importing millions of them over here. And putting a super injunction through the courts so that no one can report on it, and it ends up getting exposed years later.
Mm-hmm.
And you just like, and then that person pops up in reform, and you just like, it's like, I'm losing my mind, man.
It's
If there's some way they can squeeze less white people out of it, then they'll find the angle.
They will, exactly. Yeah, I think that's like the ultimate objective. It seems like they will find a way. They've been running in circles around it for such a long time, and it's only now we're finally beginning to kind of catch up on this. We're beginning to wrap our heads around just how bad it is, right?
Mm.
But that's also one. Go on.
I was going to say, especially here in the UK, like it feels like the 2029 general election is going to be our last shot, because I think as of 2024, I think it's something like 53% of live births in the UK were white British, which means probably this year they're less than half, which means that, you know, obviously demographics is destiny, and literally we're in the minority for the future demographics from this point on. So if it isn't turned around at 2029, what we're going to look at, and what eight years in the future for the general election after that. And it's like, at that point, is there any, would we be able to win on a numbers vote? Because you've got a younger generation that's becoming more and more non-white, non-native. So I think 2029 needs to be that big push. Cause I think just as we are heading for the end zone, I think they are as well. And once they've secured it, they'll be happy. And I think same with Israel, that, you know, they see the end in sight, potentially. Thankfully, Iran's putting up a bit of a fight for them. But yeah, they've just kind of speed run Donald Trump's second term, just like one year in, and they've just gone, it's like, yeah, we need you to go full Zogbuck. But
yeah, last chance they have, and ironically, the harder they push for this, the more credibility internationally they lose. More people end up hating them. More people end up turning against them. Maybe not the leadership of many of the countries themselves, but certainly among the population, it seems like they're not making any fans, like, if I put it that way.
No, the populations hate them. It's insane. Like approval ratings absolutely in the tank, and really is only the fact that, I mean, a lot of the European states, like vassals to that kind of American empire, Israeli American empire. So the best we can do, I think Starmer's been like, oh, we don't want to get involved. But I think if they yank that chain hard enough, eventually it'll find some way where it's like, you know, yeah, have our jets, but it's like, you know, we won't go boots on the ground. It's like, well, no one wants to go boots on the ground in Iran. It's like, have you looked at it on a map? It's literally, it's just desert mountains. It's insane.
Yeah, I know. You can't, how do you even do that? You can't. That's why this is just, this will go on. The bullshit about, I posted something earlier today, but like the, what is it, about 4 weeks. We'll be done in about four. Yeah, right. This
I
is like
that,
the 2 weeks to flatten the curve. That's basically what this is all over again. It's like, we're going to be here like in 2-3 years from now, and you know, Israel's still gonna bomb Gaza and Iran and Turkey and I don't know, there's some other country probably that will be next up.
Lebanon, it's just like, I think they've picked a fight with Lebanon now as well.
Yeah, of course, like, it's
like, all right, you wanna open yourself up to like a forefront war? It's like, you know, on your head be it.
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, something's got to give. I mean, because and yeah, that's hard. I mean, because we talk about the demographics so much, and we kind of tend to view it as things as they are now will kind of just continue. And I think no matter what end, that will that trajectory is not as certain, not just demographics, I mean, but like, let's just take the geopolitical situation or war or destabilization or oil prices up or economic turmoil or something, right? That those conditions change the dynamics. And obviously, those are really high stakes games in Western countries where so much rely on the, you know, the comfort and the, you know, energy and calories keep flowing all the time kind of thing, right? Imagine a scenario where, sure, we might be 50% of the population or something or slightly more, but things really go south and welfare is cut off and we can't take care of these people anymore. Then you have a completely different dynamic in a completely different situation where politics in and of themselves and voting obviously becomes much less important, and now it basically becomes about, essentially boils down to raw power at the end of it and who can keep, you know, these crumbling social fabric glued back together, scotch taped back together, and how long can you do that for? You can't, you know what I mean? You can't.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what comes out of it. But the point is, I think it's an interesting time because I'm saying, because I think about the demographics, I'm like, holy shit, like we got to move now. I mean, it's been like that for years. That's why we've been talking about it. But like, what I'm saying is that can change so quickly as well. And you can see people leave our countries because it's not as comfortable. And there could be other countries where it's much more comfortable than in ours. Do you see what I'm saying? I think those are very plausible outcomes in the future.
Yeah, and sometimes all it takes is one man. You know, it might be Rupert Lowe of Restore, but it's like going back to, like, I mean, the fact that we're now in this war with Iran, that essentially all, like, this, the last 2 years kind of chain of events has precipitated from the October 7th attack back in, like, 2000. That was 2024, was it?
2023, wasn't it?
2023.
Man, I got to look it up again. I think this is...
Yeah, because I think that was prior to my trial. So yeah, it must have been 2023. So we're kind of like almost 3 years on from basically like one guy hatching a plan. And then that's led to, you know, America invading Iran because, you know, events have solicited reactions, which then solicit more reactions. So yeah, it's, you know, and the Southport thing, it's like, you know, one non-white decides to make this attack, and then from there we accelerate to a point where now there's a political party, you know. It's so, yeah, who knows what the future is gonna hold, but the fact is we do seem to be politically on a positive trajectory. Rhetorically, I think we're definitely on a positive trajectory.
Yeah,
and our enemies are in, I mean, they're in like well, there's desperate times, the backs are against the wall, and they're just trying desperately to keep a hold of the conversation, and it's not working. You know, it's the replies under every tweet. Politicians are getting heckled now openly. It just seems to be a really interesting time, and I think there's going to be some exciting developments going forward.
Yeah, and I guess why I brought that up too is not to put people at ease or something like that, because there's no reason to do that. That would be shooting ourselves in the foot. No, act like we're, you know, act like this is tomorrow or it's done. You know, I mean, that's the energy we have to have. But at the same time,
go on.
Sorry.
I was going to say all these things were brought about by people who understand the situation we're in and took action. Doesn't come about from any sense of complacency or kind of like, oh, it's down the road or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's like, no, always act as if, you know, you're not going to be there tomorrow.
Yeah, no, definitely. And then at the same time, within that environment, you have to have some, you got to grant yourself to look at some of the, even if be they small, but small victories that we have, at least in terms of rhetoric then, or at least that people are talking about in a way that they haven't before, right? Because there is power in numbers. We need those numbers. We need people on our side. We need to amass a big force of people that can basically politically and or just on a community level, you know, push back against these kinds of things. And so we have to focus on the positive things that do happen so that we maintain momentum and high morale, if that makes sense. But then at the same time, realize the urgency kind of within that. It's very hard, to be honest, to balance those things. And I feel it all the time. Some days it's just like, holy shit, like it's bad. You know what I mean? And then other days, like, oh, it's all right. We're like, things are happening. It's okay. You know, and I find myself like flip-flopping between these sides all the time. You know what I mean? It's hard. Oh, smokes.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I'm a community organizer for Patriotic Alternative here in the UK. And sometimes the energy is really high and everyone's attending events and you feel like you're recruiting more and more and it's like the energy's there. And then it goes through lulls but these peaks and troughs are entirely natural. It's having the strength to carry on through a trough so you can reach the next peak. It's so important. And I mean, I've been through a pretty severe trough over the last 2 years.
Yeah, of course. Holy smokes.
But, you know, it's not dimmed the spirit or anything. Like, it's
good.
It's given me a lot of time to think about what I want to do next. And it's just reinforced everything because I've had every argument the state has against us thrown at me. And it was all just so weak. But of course it will be because whether you're in Twitter replies or in the YouTube comments or anything like that, the arguments you hear, they're not dreamed up by the person talking. They're handed down from above to them. So, of course, when you then talk to the guy above, oh, he's got exactly the same arguments. And eventually it boils down to, yeah, but why does it matter? And it's like,
yeah, you had
if you're of that much.
You had your post, I think you were describing that in the post, or I forget what it was, where I read it, but it was like you were talking about that. Like, this, it was almost like you're not allowed to have those opinions because they're just, we've decided as a society that they're bad or something. And if you don't hold those views, then like, what's your interest here? Like, we can't put ourselves in the heads of, how can you not care about your people? And they're almost like that in reverse. Like, how can you care about your people? What's the point, right, kind of thing. It's just a total clash of worldviews. And right now the liberal, you know, anti-white boomer mind is the one with the power, the political power and sway in the system and legislation. And they can, you know, tell the police to do this or that or whatever. But it's like, but it's a dying system. It's withering away. But it still holds the remnants of power. Is that right?
Yeah, because I mean, it's anti-survival for one. Like, it seems to almost be the product of like a faulty amygdala that can't assess threats you're not seeing the environment you're in and understanding it on any level. You know, you've got these people welcoming in these migrant boats or whatever and being like, oh, asylum seekers or something. And it's like, you know, we have eyes. We can see that it's a bunch of like 20 something guys who are all claiming to be 12. You know, this is the kind of mindset that they have where it's like they don't see what it seems to be the bleeding obvious. And there was a moment in my trial where I realized the kind of people we're up against. And it was when we were presenting the evidence for the rape gangs and we were churning through so many records of what had happened to these girls. And the prosecution came back to me and went, oh, but you don't know them, do you? You're not related to them or anything. And I was like, well, no, I'm not personally related to them. And he just went, okay, and moved on. But then during the closing statement, he said, oh, you might be a confused as to Sam's tears, because I'd welled up when we were came, because it's like, you know, talking about girls, you know, 50 men a night, you know, they're all spaced out on drugs and everything like that, and just and then just dumped naked in the field, and it's like really grim reading. And he said, it's like, you might be confused, you know, by his crocodile tears, you know, how could someone care about someone they don't know, you know? And it's like, really, this is just a cover for his racist beliefs. And I was like, oh my, like,
wow,
you really can't empathize with other members of your group. It's like and that's how multiculturalism works, and why you can forgive something like the Manchester Evening Bombing and, you know, not look back in anger, because it's like they're someone else and you don't know them personally, therefore it hasn't affected you, you know. And the girl being raped above the local takeaway, that's someone else, you know, and the people doing it as well, similarly, they're just an individual cipher. There's no identifying group to them or anything like that, so you can't start to draw conclusions from that and start to notice trends or anything. And that's the kind of thinking that multiculturalism requires in order to move forward, because every day you're faced with new horrors, and the only way you could not stand up against it and start to rail against the system is by basically taking every new day, every new horror, as completely, you know, there's no history to it. You haven't seen one before, and it's like, and this fresh one is just kind of like, oh, I can't believe this individual did that to another individual. And it's like, no, we're seeing trends. This group is doing it to our group.
Yeah,
right. And they just don't have that.
No, they don't.
You know, and so I think, you know, it might die out naturally, but the problem is, will there be enough of us to continue when it does eventually die out naturally?
Because, yeah, you know, I know.
I don't think that mindset is going to survive another 100 years.
No, definitely not. It will be, either we'll just die of natural causes, or it'll be taken out by the very, you know, in their xenophilic, you know, attitudes towards the other, essentially, they will basically be succumb to them as a group in some way.
They'll
or another.
Choose not to cross the street when any rational person would do.
exactly. But yeah, no, that's a good point. It's that here's an isolated incident with individuals, and there's no pattern recognition there, and then we forget about that, and then here's another isolated incident with individuals involved, and there is no pattern recognition over time or mapping, but they can map and track, you know, you and the network of people that are trying to fight against that. They can see a threat assessment within their own group, and somehow that there's a force here that threatens us to change the demographics. They're trying to stop this great project that we have ongoing in replacing our own people. And so they do have it on some level. They do have it. It's just that they have no vision for, I guess, their own group to a certain extent, or standing up for their own.
We see their analysis of us, and it's like they do treat it like some sort of mental disorder. They can't really fathom why we do what we do, and similarly, my probation officer is like, why would you continue doing this when it's cost you so much? And it'd be like, it's like, because this is existential. I'm doing it for my group, you know, for the same reason the soldier jumps on the grenade in the trench. It's a form of self-sacrifice, and I think that as well. There's no kind of concept of self-sacrifice within their minds. At least not for white people, for sure.
No, definitely. Oh man. So what do you feel now? What do you want to do? What's your plans? What's your next moves here?
I mean, first it's trying to get my feet back under me. I feel like I've fallen behind in the race and I'm trying to catch up. But I'm gonna be continuing with Patriotic Alternative. I'm gonna retake my role as Yorkshire Regional Organizer. Because I feel like no matter what happens in the future, a tight, cohesive community is going to be an essential part of that, and finding people who think similarly and act similarly. And then I'm really interested to see where Restore goes. To be honest, I think I'd be open for running for like an MP if they'd have me. I mean, I know they've said they don't want any kind of political political animals who have been doing this their entire lives or anything. They want people who have worked and experienced life properly. So it's like, maybe that'd be an option. But generally, it's like, we just got to carry on with this cause. And I'm open to everything. I mean, coming out, it's like seeing how many groups here in the UK are now working together, you know, kind of cross-pollinating and everything. It's fantastic. Like, that wasn't there when I went away. You know, it was kind of quite fractious, and that's really come together now. So I think that puts us in a really strong point moving forward. You know, we've got a demonstration. I mean, that Warwick demo you've got on screen there, I think there must have been about 8 different groups.
Yeah, that's Steve Laws up there, right, in the photo.
Steve Laws, and it's like, it's like him. I've met him before, and he's great. And I look forward to seeing him again. I think we've got a demonstration at the end of this month, and we'll be getting the band back together for that as well.
Nice.
But it's seeing all these people together, and like we were talking about before, having our backs against the wall and acting like there's not going to be a tomorrow, I think has really helped people realize that the petty differences just, they don't matter, you know. And it's like, what really matters is that we turn that country around.
Yeah.
And I think we've got a damn good chance of doing it. I mean, yeah, there you've got
Right at the end there. Yep.
So, like, these guys who, you know, from so many different walks of life and everything. I think that might actually be Sven Longshanks in the background, just to the left of Laura there.
Oh yeah, you're right. It might be right, isn't it? Yeah.
I think it is. Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's jail doesn't dim people.
No,
like us,
no, definitely.
You know
not.
What I mean? It's like we come out of it stronger and better. So I'm really looking forward to kind of jumping back into the fray.
Yeah.
At the moment, I'm just trying to get this book out because I think it's very interesting to see how the agents of the state work and their mindset. And then also for anyone who's facing this kind of experience in the future, it's not as going to be as scary as you're expecting it to be. Because no doubt there will be further arrests. They'll try and clamp down on it more, but like I said, with that pressure cooker, it's you can put the lid back on it, but it just comes out.
That's just
steamier than ever.
It's just the name of the game. That's just the circumstances we face. I mean, again, either we fight or we die. That's really what it comes down to. Either we go extinct or we try to do something about it. And whatever comes in our way, that's an obstacle that we have to overcome one way or another. Let me take a couple of these chats here, and then I want to talk about your book there, obviously, a little bit to help promoting that. Ghost Dog Man said, sent a 5 and 0 slashy, and then he sent another one for 10. Thank you, sir. He says, pointing out the lice can't poke holes through it because people aren't motivated to listen, as their bread is bathed in anti-whiteism. I guess you mean like the butter. Yeah, the bread is bathed in anti-whiteism, lies, and the basis for global humanity's zeitgeist economy. Get whitey. Thank you, Ghost Dog. Appreciate that. We got Albert with a huge donor here, too. Thank you so much, Albert. We appreciate you so much. He says, hi, Henrik. I'm going to catch this after work. Take care. Thank you, Albert. Much love to you. Hope everything is good. We appreciate you so much. Thank you so much, Albert. You're incredible. We got Andy here as well. It says, hi, Sam Melia. Hail a race. Join Restore Britain. Also, buy Sam Melia's book or you're not a patriot. Yeah, that's right. Don't be a fag. Buy the book. How about that?
Thank you.
That's the. tell us about. Did you begin writing this when you were in there? You think like, I better turn this into, or like, might as well, can I be productive as I'm in here? Or did the idea for the book come later? Tell us about how you
the idea
together.
For the book definitely came later. I was writing from the first day, but when you come in, you get this tiny diary with you know, and each day is like this big. And I was kind of filling it in, just being like, well, you know, it'd be good to have a record, if like that. But then I think I was about a week or two in, and I was like, so much stuff was going on. I think I'd seen someone have a kettle of boiling water thrown over them. There'd been a fight over the pool table. I think someone had tried to attack someone else in the shower, but then the naked guy in the shower had got the better of him. So it was like so much wild stuff was happening that I was kind of like, this, I've got to go into more detail than this tiny little passage is going to allow. And And I was given a notebook from the library guy, and I started to fill out more and more. And I started to start talking about things I saw on the news, and how I thought this would affect politics and stuff like that. So it ended up being quite interesting, you know, or at least I thought so. And then I typed it up, and Laura had a read through it, and she couldn't put it down. So I was like, all right, cool. So it's not just me who thinks it's entertaining. But a lot of it as well, especially when I started meeting with the probation team in November, just before my release, I was like, this has got to go down on some sort of record when I've got my probation officer telling me that the difference between me and him is that he loves multiculturalism, while at the same time I'm being told that their political bias doesn't play any role in my prosecution or my realignment following it. And it's like, feels like it does, because you're getting pretty irate at me, you know. So just have a record of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? No, it's necessary to see. You need the that's one thing we've traditionally been bad at, I think, within these circles, to actually get the personal story, right? The other side is kind of overly focused on that and not on the big picture, while we always are big picture and not on the personal story, right? But, like, you really need to get into the nitty-gritty of, like, look, how is the process for a case like this, for someone being in that situation? It's the same thing with, take the grooming gang victims or something like that, right? There needs to be just one girl, like, her story told in its entirely. I mean, in a way to really convey the damage of this and the toll that this is taking on these young girls' lives
There was a book that kind of blew the kind of the rape gang thing wide open. It's called Easy Meat, but
that's right, yeah,
a lot of kind of personal and the same with Lowe's grooming gang inquiry that is just done, the kind of evidence collection of the actual stories. And then we saw like huge names, like people like Bear Grylls going like, hang on, this is going on in the UK, and you think, it's like, how does someone not know about this?
I know, exactly. Bizarre, huh?
But I mean, I spoke to, there was a guy I was briefly in with who was 25, and he had never heard of the grooming gangs. And I was just like, how have you not come across this at any point? But, you know, I don't know if that's part of that mindset we were talking about, where you take every day as a new, you know, a whole new world where you disregard what you heard yesterday. But it's like they were effective at suppressing this, so it's we need to get more of these stories out. I think in this case with my book, the story is just the state overreach and the heavy-handed oppression of people who have legal truthful views.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, we've had they sent child services after us to make a determination on whether we were fit and healthy parents based on our political views. You know, thankfully Laura was the one tussling with them, and basically argued back. It's like, you can't do this. This is completely against our rights and everything.
Yeah.
And got them to back down. But it's like, that's included in the book as well. Right. So it's like, if anyone out there has these similar views, is dealing with child services, here's the exact email exchange that says what you need to say to let them know that it's like they are completely overreaching
on
this, you know?
Yeah. What was it? I think it was Mark Collett who was talking about that. It was, I think it was when you were allowed to have the kids come visit, but you could, but it was something there like they were, you might influence them, you know, badly. And so you weren't allowed to be around. What was that? Tell us about that a little bit more.
So that, while I was away in prison, I think about 3 months in, all of a sudden, I'd got told that a letter had been bounced back to Laura. And then an officer visited me and said, you need to consent to a child services assessment to have continued access to your children. And I was like, what? I was like, my crime isn't to do with, you know, children or anything like that. It's like, what's this about? And she's like, you've got to consent to the assessment. And I was like, I'm not signing anything to say that I'm, you know, a potential threat to my own children. And this went on for 2 months with us arguing with them. And I think Laura and Mark arranged like a kind of mailing in campaign to the prison, to the point where the prison had to relent and say, like, please stop people getting in touch we've reestablished, we'll let you see your kids again and everything. But it was required for us to have an assessment with the with child services. They visited Laura at home with the kids, and then they had a phone call with me. But it was 2 months there where I wasn't allowed to see them. Laura couldn't tell me about them over the phone or via email or anything like that. And it was absolutely bizarre, you know, and to finally have that dealt with. And then when I got out, I had a midday check-in at 1 o'clock every day, which meant that, you know, you couldn't take your kids on a proper day out because you'd always have to be back at this approved premises where they kept me for 7 months post-release. And when I asked why, it was like, well, we don't want to have too much time with your family, you know, so we've got to split the day up. And you're just like, it's like, are kids more susceptible to radicalization at like the middle of the day or something? It's like, this is madness. But yeah, it's like they, you know, after release from prison, I couldn't tuck my kids in to bed for 7 months because I was required to be back at this hostel.
Oh my gosh.
You know, because of the potential, you know, danger to my family or whatever. Yeah, and that was the kind of final jab at me in December when they filed that child services report and said I had to go through an assessment. And I was like, no, we're not doing this.
Do you think that will... Do you fear that they'll kind of keep eyeing you especially more than others, or are there bigger targets now? Is you do you see what I'm saying? Like that there's so many others now talking about it.
Definitely bigger targets out there. However, obviously the one thing they've got against me is now an existing conviction. Previously I was of good character. You know, I hadn't had any run-ins with the police, no convictions prior. So, you know, I got 2 years. If I went down for similar speech crimes again, no doubt I'd be getting the 5-7 year sentence or something like that. So I'm definitely conscious of what I'm putting out there. But I've also learned a lot while I've been away. And in terms of the stickers, probably wasn't the best way of putting them out there because it's kind of like a fire and forget thing where it's like you're putting the message out there and then anything can happen past that point. Whereas like with the public demonstrations and speaking, you know, you can get people fired up, but then it's the responsibility of the speaker to then it's like direct that energy somewhere positive. So, you know, you'll close it instead of going like, it's like, you're angry, go out and do whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's kind of like, it's like, no, here's exactly what you need to do. You want to join PA, you want to get involved with this X, Y, Z, whatever. So, and obviously we went through that trial and none of my work with PA was highlighted. And that was all kind of post 100 handers. So it's like, well, you know, if they didn't seek to bury me with anything I'd done with PA, you know, I've been demonstrating outside migrant hotels and everything. It's like, you would have thought if any of that was a slam dunk, they would have used it, but they didn't. They didn't bring PA up at all really in the trial. So that tells me that going forward, continuing as I was prior to the trial is probably fine.
Okay, good. How's the obviously the family, the kids? How has it been for them? Especially your oldest, you know.
Yeah, I mean she's 4, just turned 4. Yeah. I mean, lucky in a way that they were so young.
Yeah.
When I went away, you know, I was released before Christmas, so we kind of told them a white lie and that I was away working with Santa's elves, building toys. Quite how I would have looked in that elf workshop, I'm not sure. But it's like, you know, it's like he's back for Christmas because he's done his job and everything. I'm like, cool, brilliant, you know. And there doesn't seem to be, you know, to say that I missed the first 10 months of Violet's life, I don't think that's, it doesn't seem to have had an impact, thankfully. You know, I felt really bad for some of the prisoners in there, like teenage kids who were very aware that they're visiting their father in prison.
Yeah.
Whereas mine, I mean, they wondered where I was, that's for sure. But Laura was really good at keeping my memory alive for them through the week. And then we managed to get visits pretty much every weekend. So, you know, they saw me plenty.
Okay, well, that's
good. There were some times, like at the end of the visits, there was one time where Catherine was just kind of, she kept running up to me and hugging me while I was waiting to leave the visiting room. And she'd run back, run forward and everything. And then the last hug, I said, oh, I'm really sorry, I've got to go back to work. And she was begging me to stay there.
Oh, gosh.
And, yeah. You know, the officer's kind of like, basically, if you don't come through, I'm going to grab you through. And you're like, chill, you know.
Yeah.
But then she ran back to the play area and got like a toy set of keys and was trying to unlock the door. And it's like, you know, it's, but yeah, it all seems to have just gone past them, and thankfully it's not got any lasting impact on them.
They adapt in incredible ways, and especially at that age, you know what I mean? So it will be, yeah, that's fortunate, as opposed to if, you know, they're 7, 8, 9, you know, years old. But yeah, I feel for you, man. Holy smokes, I can't even imagine. Oof, hard times, you know, man. You've done good. You've done very, very good. So have your family. So has Laura, obviously, as well. Very, very courageous. High spirits throughout this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I got out, and it's like all of a sudden, instead of one kid, there was two, and I was like, this is really overwhelming. And Laura was like, yeah, I've been doing it for a year. You know, it's like, yeah. It's been intense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It gets intense. It's funny. Okay, one more from Ghost Dog Man, who says, I'm speaking about white people too. I guess it's in reference to the previous comment I read here, obviously. I called an anti-white winger's stock market as being anti-white SOG poison. He looked at me like I was poison for questioning his financial investment. Baked in. Thank you for that. We got a couple of here too. Der Scherisker, good episode and good text. Also, the mic is working better today. Keep on fighting. I didn't know it was not working good last time, but that's good.
I had
good.
Some problems on Mark.
Oh, is it that what he's talking? Yeah. Okay, I thought he was talking about my mic for some reason. Okay, there you go.
No, it's me. It was about like 20 minutes. It was across the desk from me. I didn't realize it had to be like...
Gotcha. Okay, well, thank you, Der Scherisker. Appreciate that. Andy, everyone needs to try to go to the demo in Newington. Is that how you say it? Newington? I saw it up on the...
Nuneaton.
Nuneaton. There you go. Nuneaton.
Yeah, it's around the Midlands of the UK.
Midlands of the UK. On the 28th, it's going to be massive. I think it's on the front page here of this one right here. There you go.
We've got a lot of groups coming to it. And nice. I mean, there's been people who have like relative kind of normies prior to me going away. And they were shocked that I was, and they're like, it's like, yeah, we're coming to the next thing, you know, it's great, we're gonna buy your book, it's all, you know? It's like, it's, oh, brilliant. So it's like you've kind of radicalized over the last 2 years. Brilliant.
Yeah, well, that's just it, right? That's kind of interesting, because they talk about how obviously being away in those conditions is like a freezing, you know, you're like you're stuck in time in a way, right? I mean, you can still watch some news or whatever, but like you couldn't keep up with like, you know, meme culture on the internet when you were in, let's be honest. No. So, you know, so it's like things advance quite rapidly all of a sudden, you know. Yeah. That's hilarious. All right. Well, what else should we... Okay, so obviously the book here is... it's available for pre-order now, right? Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I've finished, I think, the second final run-through of the manuscript and got it back to my proofreader. There's someone within PA who does it professionally. So I've paid him to do it, and he's done a fantastic job, because I've got no formal training in this writing. So he's made it a lot more legible than it probably was before. I think he's having one final run through, and then I can get it kind of laid out as exactly as I wanted. I got a test copy. You can see above my shoulder.
Yeah,
I think the camera's mirrored, and it's throwing me off.
Yep.
But I got a test copy because the cover I designed myself. And everything, and I kind of struck upon that it's like one final sticker as a little FU to the system on the front cover. So that's exactly what the 100-handed stickers look like, the same font, the logo on the side, and everything there. So it's like I've got that.
And the number, top right corner.
Yeah. We never had a number 000, so I guess this will be that one.
There you go.
And Mark Collett was kind enough to put a foreword together for me as well, so we've got that included, but I'm hoping for a mid-March release. And then at some point I'll get it up on Amazon as well, but obviously the best way to support me and the work I'm doing and Laura and the family and everything is to buy it through our website. You can pick up some tea and coffee as well while you're there.
I'll spell it out, grandmatowlers.co.uk, for those who don't know.
Yeah,
that's the website. We'll copy it, we'll put it in the Rumble chat here too, so people can see. Check that out. The shop segment there. Yeah, you have a right now for the book. You have a paperback and then a ebook, I think, right?
Well. So some people were asking for an ebook.
I
haven't been away that long that I don't know what ebooks
are. That's good.
There was a in the hostel, there was a guy, I think he'd been away for 15 years, and he was out, and he'd been given his first smartphone, and he was like,
"Oh my gosh,
screen's dark, how do you lighten the screen?" And I was like, "How long have you been away?" And he's like, 15 years. I'm like, "Oh my God, yeah, you went away before smartphones." It's like, that's mind-blowing that someone could come out. And I mean, I think it's something like 80% recall rate for people out on license, and so many just want to get back inside. And I imagine if you've done 15, 20 years, you know, it's like a Shawshank Redemption when that crow guy gets out. It's like the whole world got itself in a damn hurry.
Yeah.
And it's like you've gone away and it was like chocolate bar phones and everything. And then it's like you could come out and now you've got a supercomputer in your hand that's talking to you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Chat GPT, like, oh my gosh, can you imagine?
Yeah.
What the fuck is this?
AI before I went away.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, there was a bit about, you know, Dali or whatever doing drawings like, with people with eight hands or whatever. And now you've come out and some people seem to run their life via Chat GPT, don't they?
Yeah, their counselor, their partner.
Yeah.
Their lover, even. Apparently. Yeah. They marry these things now.
Yeah, there was that film, wasn't there, with Joaquin Phoenix,
her. Or
however you pronounce it.
Yep.
Her, yeah.
Very good, very good.
Crazy.
Very good. Yeah, I've recommended it a couple of times to the audience, just to get like an emotional insight into like someone that kind of gets trapped by, and I mean, that case is an operating system, but it's obviously a chat bot, whatever you want to call it, same thing, right? But just like that, how he over time just kind of, it just kind of happens, right? He just develops an emotional bond with this thing, you know what I mean? And it talks back to you like a woman, so he gets attracted, you know, like, you know, associated with it. Very, very, very bizarre future here. Okay, so yeah, grandmatowlers.co.uk, that's the website. And as you said, you guys have a bunch of other stuff on there too. Obviously, tea, coffee, things like that. So check that out, ladies and gentlemen. Very good. Well, what else would you like to, I guess, leave us with here, Sam, before we begin wrapping up here for today?
Oh, wow. Remain positive. I know obviously blackpilling is a thing and everything, but it's like I can tell you that I've probably been through what should have been the most blackpilling experience possible, and I've come out of it thinking that we've got a brighter future than ever, and our enemies are weaker than I think we thought they were. I know that's what I came out of thinking, was like, wow, it's not a case of winning the argument. The argument's essentially already being won. Now it's a case of basically shooting for power in order to make the changes. So that's what I'll leave people with. Never blackpill, and let's win this thing.
Let's keep fighting. That's right. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Sam. I appreciate it. Great conversation. It was a pleasure, having you. I think we had you on together with Laura many, many years ago now, right? Man,
yeah,
when was that?
So.
Like 2018, maybe 19? Oh, gosh, I can't remember. Something like that. Anyway, so it's quite a while ago. But anyway, so I'm glad to be able to have you on again and talk about this ordeal and having it behind you and moving on. And yeah, being just the overall, I mean, as I say, right, true victory is you know, living well and in spite the fact of how your enemy is trying to destroy your life and ruin you and things like this, right? And just like kind of chin up and holding your head up high and keep moving forward and being convicted in what you're doing. And obviously you're an example of that. And so well done, sir. We appreciate your, unnecessary, but yet, these are the conditions that it is, sacrifice basically for the cause and for your people in Britain. You know what I mean?
Oh, thank you. And thank you for having me on. It's been an honor to be on Red Ice and to speak to you, Henrik, as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Sam. All right. Appreciate it. We'll touch base and keep up the good work. I'm sure we'll stay in touch and have you back here soon. But yeah, keep up the good work and hold the spirits high, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks.
See ya.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you. We appreciate that. Thank you to Sam again for joining us. Appreciate it. We'll be back here with more, obviously, tomorrow, Flashback Friday. We'll be back for some good stuff. We're going to cover some of the, obviously, news in regards to what's going on in the Middle East and some other things as well. It's three days since we did the Western Warrior Show, where we kind of covered the initial beginning of the war and why they did it and the timing of it, more so than anything. And of course, that feels like 3 months because you're just away for 3 days and not doing anything. Actually, I had a birthday party for my youngest boy yesterday, so that's why we didn't do anything yesterday. But again, appreciate Sam's time. Hope you all enjoyed it. Thank you so much, everybody. Oh, I do want to say thanks to all the executive producers here before we let you guys go as well. Where are you guys? Here we go. Let's rattle these off here real quick before we wrap up the show. Arctic Wolf, first out the gate. Thank you, Albert. We appreciate you so much. We also have William Fox from America First Books. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. We got Angry White Soccer Mom, also one of our executive producers, together with Purple Haze. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Then we got Glenn as well. Thank you, Glenn. Much appreciated. We have President Obunga as well. We appreciate your support as well. Thank you. We got Good Luck Lap. Appreciate you as well. Thank you, man. Appreciate it. We got Number One Jeebs. Thank you so much for your support. Also, one of our executive producers, Hungarian Mom. Thank you. Appreciate it. We got Sun Destroyer 520. Thank you to you as well. We got the Deplorable Extraordinaire. Thank you to you as well. Santoso is joining us among the ranks of executive producers as well. Thank you. Also, thanks to the Boo Man. We appreciate you, the Boo Man. Thank you. And Charles Turner Jr., last but not least, for our executive producers. Thank you. Appreciate it. We got Red Pill Rundown, Yuan Son, Lero Demand, Ice Open, Single Action Army. We have Lord H.P. Lovecraft, Trevor, Der Schwabe, Alcyon, Aurelian, Perfect Brute. We have Greg M., J. Barr, Chris W., Skarzinski, Muskrat, Centurion, Scott James Henderson, Deer in the Headlights, Joseph W., Citizen Intel, and Ernst Jaeger. Thank you, guys. If you want a shout out from us, name in the credits, a special thanks from us here at Red Ice so we can grow and expand. You can get one of those membership tiers at redicemembers.com or subscribestar.com/redice. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Great way to support it. You can get a regular membership as well. That does help. Check out Lana's Llama. If you want to pick up one of these Red Ice hoodies, you can do that at lanaslama.com. Really comfy, good quality stuff. But yeah, guys, we'll be back with more tomorrow. We'll see you then. Folk first. Now, do make sure that you follow us on our Rumble channel for more Red Ice TV on Rumble.com or on X at Red Ice TV. You can, of course, go to redice.tv as well. Tune in to our live streams and shows, Flashback Friday, live on Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern, No-Go Zone Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern. We also do interviews, videos, clips, and Western Warrior is available Tuesdays, exclusive for our supporters and subscribers at redicemembers.com or on our locals, redicetv.locals.com or subscribestar.com/redice. Get a membership, check out everything that we do, and support the show.
New Red Ice merch available now. Folk First t-shirts for adults and for toddlers. Fatigues for men. Our favorite, the Red Ice camper mug or ceramic with black print. High quality leather keychain with solar boat imprint. Our Red Ice hat, one of our best sellers. Pick one up today. Or why not? Gray Auslander Rouse t-shirts for both women and men. We also have Fridge Magnets, Folk First, One Disease, and our black men's t-shirt with the classic red solar boat. Folk First. Get your Red Ice merch from lanaslama.com. Get an item today. Lana's Llama, proud sponsor of Red Ice.